Game on, weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
And a very good evening from Damien O'Mara. You are most welcome to the Tuesday edition of Game On. Plenty to come between now and 7 o'clock. It is the evening after the evening before. We will reflect somewhat on the Republic of Ireland's win over Gibraltar at the Aviva Stadium last night. We're going to focus more so on a story that was breaking as we were on air last night, the Republic of Ireland under-21s and their game against Kuwait, which was taking place in Austria, being abandoned as the result of an alleged incident of racial abuse on the touchline. More on that to come in a minute. Mark Langdon with us to chat. It's not even European football anymore. It's kind of about how Saudi Arabia has become the centre of the footballing world. And you might think that's been a little bit excessive, but we've a big list of stories in front of us. And the first two pages of it are all about this player's linked to Saudi, that player's linked to Saudi. Steven Gerrard's not going to Saudi. Matt Doherty probably is. We'll come to that in a couple of minutes' time. We're going to check in with Ruby, who's at Royal Ascot, and Roddy Forsyth on the news which emerged in recent days about Brendan Rodgers heading back to Celtic Park, and Scotland, who are on course to make their own little piece of international football history this evening. And we could all well be entertaining the notion of celebrating and supporting our Celtic cousins at the Euro 2024 finals next year.
Game on 2FM.
51552 for your text, at Game on 2FM for your tweets. Alan Cawley, I saw you fleetingly in Derry. Was that last Friday or the Friday before? The weeks have all blended into one.
Yeah, last Friday, wasn't it?
Was it last Friday? No, it wasn't, because it's a summer break.
The Friday gone, yeah. So we had Ireland-Greece Friday, and then we had Derry the week before, and we're all back to it again this Friday.
We met, we had like a brief man hug, as you do, you know, and
nice pleasantries, as we do. Yeah, it's good to see you.
And then you ran off to do your job, and I ran off to do my job, and then we ran into our cars to go home. So it's good to see you. Listen, a lot to chat about. Before we get stuck into the international football last night, your brief assessment, like a 3-0 win over Gibraltar, as great as it is and all, to see a couple of goals and walk away from the Aviva celebrating a victory, it's a disappointing international window all in.
Oh, it's incredibly disappointing, Damien. And that's my overriding feeling, because as everybody knows, I wanted Stephen to do really well. I was all for Stephen, and it wasn't a case of blind loyalty because of obviously he's from the League of Ireland in the background and we know Stephen. It was more a case of I felt he's the right man at this moment in time to hopefully bring them forward. Obviously his ideas on what he wanted to do, he had to implement a lot in terms of bringing young players through and starting from a very low base. But now we're at the stage where this campaign, I have openly said numerous times that he'll be judged on this campaign. We're 3 years into it now, and to see not so much the result, that's hugely disappointing Friday, but the manner of the performance and the result, that was so damaging, I felt, for Stephen. And that's what's disappointed me so much, Damien, because as I said, I've been a huge fan of what he was trying to do and wanted him to succeed. And for the first time since he's got the job, I'm questioning it, like strongly, and to the point where I think he's hanging on.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things. The squad had extended time in camp, and the thing that when you look at it, there were so many aspects of both games in patches, particularly the Greece game, where there doesn't, the coherence, you know, connections, awareness between players, partnerships, all of that stuff that you know your system, you drill your system, you play your system. If you're not available, someone else steps in. Everybody knows what's expected and you slot in. Like, that's not evident, which is, that's the big concern about an international setup where so much structure and so much focus is put on team setup because you have such a limited window with the players.
Absolutely, and for the unusual thing about this one was that he had so long with the players, and that was the whole kind of narrative around it, Damien. In all the previous games and performances and camps, it might only be the 2 or 3 day build up and you're into a game and then you're recovering and you're playing another game if it's a double header, or sometimes even 3 games in that week or 10 days, whereas this was a complete build up towards one game, because we always felt the Gibraltar game was obviously the second in line and that they were always going to get the victory. So everything, all your eggs were going into this basket of the Greece game in terms of preparation, and all that was going supposedly really good, very positive, all the sound bites we were hearing, the warm weather training camp. So we were all set for this performance that we were hoping, and we all knew how pivotal this game was going to be. Now, unfortunate for Stephen, maybe in the sense that because of the scheduling of the games, this pivotal game came only 2 games into the campaign, obviously off the back of the France one. Sometimes you normally have a case of where it could be 5 or 6 games into a campaign, you have a hugely pivotal one. But Greece were in a similar position to us, that they were viewing us with a from a viewpoint that if we beat Ireland, we have a good chance of taking something off Netherlands, the same way as we were.
It was the cup final of saying who's going to finish behind France.
And then to put in the performance where we never laid a glove on them, Damien, as you say, all those plans and structures that we were hoping would be in place to try and implement our game on them just never happened. We were totally dominated from start to finish, and that's where the question marks are come from, and I suppose that's why the questions are being asked of Stephen.
When we look at last night, in a way I often feel like the game against Gibraltar is a no-win situation. You beat them 5 or 6-0, you're expected to beat them 5 or 6-0, you beat them 3-0. Like, it's a bit soft in my mind to be saying, well, France beat them 3-0 and Netherlands beat them 3-0 and we've beaten them 3-0, because we struggled so much in the first half. And okay, you can laud the tactical change at half time, like Mikey Johnson changed that match, and you have to look at a player who has that level of creativity, excites the crowd. Is he not a player that you fast track and you have him more prominent and you build that attacking third around him?
I've always stuck up for Stephen, but you don't laud that as a tactical masterstroke. The whole world could see that it needed changing, and obviously Mikey Johnson is one that will come on, in the sense that he adds that bit of spark. The question I would ask is, why wasn't he on from the start? Why did we play a three at the back?
When they've made such an effort to get him to switch allegiance.
Especially in a game, I can understand the games where he didn't play in the previous ones, because obviously you're going in a little bit more with, I suppose, an eye on the fact that you're trying to be defensively well set up. But in a game where you're going to have 80% of the ball against Gibraltar, who were an absolute shambles, like, I've seen Gibraltar many times, and when you think they're still lining out with a 40-year-old at the back, Damien, like, and you're talking about progress, where's their progress? They're an absolute shambles, Gibraltar. So you can't wake up today and think, oh, 3-0, we played great, that was a good performance, blah blah. You can't take anything from that, nothing at all. The only thing you'd be taking from that is the fact that, why didn't we, and this is a question for Stephen with some of the teams we play, because he was always 4-3-3 at Dundalk, Damien. We've all seen his teams. He always had Daryl Horgan and Mikey Duffy, two excellent wingers in the mould of a Mikey Johnson. I'm surprised that he never started him last night. Obviously he came on, he done well, but you can't take anything out of that last night.
Okay, we'll come back to that in due course. 51552 for your text, at GameOn2FM for your tweets. The big story though last night, the situation revolving around the Irish under-21s in Austria for what's effectively a flood
training
of... There's a whole
camp,
load of friendlies and training camps taking place. We had a situation last night which emerged just as we were coming on air. A situation, alleged racist remarks directed towards somebody on the Irish bench. Ireland obviously making the decision, well in control of the game, to walk off the pitch and a show of solidarity and a protest against what it was they felt had taken place. A fresh FAI statement today which says, during the second half of Ireland under-21's international friendly with Kuwait under-22s in Austria on Monday evening, we can once again confirm that a racist remark was made to an Ireland substitute by a Kuwaiti player. The comment was heard by a number of Ireland players who reported this immediately to match officials as well as to members of the Ireland and Kuwait team staff. Due to the nature of the remark made and no affirmative action in relation to our opponents, the game was abandoned. FAI staff and players were in full support of this decision. The FAI has offered its full and unequivocal support to the player who was subjected to racism and to his teammates. We can again confirm that we will be reporting this matter to FIFA and UEFA. The FAI does not tolerate any racism towards any of our players or staff. In response, the Kuwait Olympic Association, who govern their football, basically said, this isn't what happened. What happened was the game was overly aggressive, and as a result of that, the decision was made to abandon the match. We also had a situation last night where we had a second international friendly, which also had to be abandoned for the exact same incident. We'll chat about this in just a minute. Jim Crawford, who, to put it in context, I think was one of the first players or people within Irish football to really come out strongly in support of, you know, football against racism in Ireland, and a lot of those anti-racism campaigns when they were originated a couple of years back. I don't think this is the first time one of his teams has taken part in a show of solidarity like this. He has done an interview with the FAI's social media channels where he gives his perspective on the events as they played out.
We knew it was going to be a challenging match. You know, Kuwait are preparing for an Asian Cup, and we're obviously preparing for the European Championships in September. So, you know, we, as normal, we worked hard on the training pitch and we're expecting a competitive game. And, you know, after the hour mark, we believe there was a racist incident that we're certainly not going to stand for. One of our players was racially abused, and it certainly upset and annoyed a lot of our players. And when I found the details about it, you know, we as a whole group decided that there's no way we're going to play this game. And I do have to commend the level of maturity that our players showed. Everybody was calm about it, and you know, we stepped aside. We waited out on the pitch until Kuwait had left the dressing room area. And you know, it was a real disappointing end to our international window. But I do think we cannot tolerate this type of behaviour in society, in sport. And you know, for me, what we did was the right thing to do, and it's something that we certainly, with the under 21s group, is something that we stand for.
That's Jim Crawford chatting to the FAI earlier today. As mentioned, I was on duty post-match doing the interviews in the mix zone where a number of the Irish players come through, and one of the players who was put forward for interview last night was James McLean. Now, it's somewhat unusual that the player who captains the side would also come through to the mix zone, but he was on duty last night, and obviously he is someone who, for a multitude of reasons, has found himself at the centre or the subject of an awful lot of sectarian abuse in particular in recent years. So I put it to him about what had happened in the 21 game and what it was his assessment was of that show of solidarity.
Can I just finish? I know your focus was on tonight. The 21s game earlier was abandoned because of an incident of alleged racism on the sideline. You have had to endure more focus and scrutiny than any other Irish player we've ever had. Is it time the teams take that action and walk off the pitch and show solidarity with teammates and backroom staff?
Well, if that's what they've done, then, you know, absolutely credit bid and fair play. You know, it's shown that they're with their teammate. And we're in 2023, you know, it's absolutely ridiculous that scene has to be the case. But look, all I can say is absolute credit to the lads for how they handle themselves and walking off the pitch and showing solidarity with their teammates. It shouldn't happen, but, you know, I think, like I said, fair play.
That's James McLean chatting last night. Now, let's be very honest, this is a societal problem. It happens in workplaces, in educational facilities, it happens in the public streets day to day. It happens in football, it happens in sport. That gets, in very many cases, an increased level of attention because of the global nature of football and the focus that's on elite sport. In 2023, this should be the norm. This should not be a situation where it's suddenly a big story that two teams have walked off the pitch, because this should have happened more often. Fair play to the lads for what they've done if they believe this incident took place and they wanted to support and defend their teammate.
Yeah, and I do believe it did take place, because Jim Crawford is one of the most honest, decent people that you'll ever come across. I know Jim pretty well. I played with him, a man of integrity, and he'll stand up for his players and his staff as well, Damien. And you mentioned the fact that this should be the norm. It'll only become the norm when these kind of actions are taken. And until people start doing this on a regular basis, we heard of the stuff there recently with Vinicius Jr. in the league, absolutely disgraceful stuff that he has to deal with.
But then he's blamed by the league.
Well, there you
go.
He's
blamed by the league for stoking it. Now, I know you can say James McLean is a different situation. James McLean has, at times in his life, made decisions which have provoked a reaction, and he has had to deal with that reaction. But they're two completely separate issues.
Yeah, and they'll all be separate incidents. What amazes me about this one, Damien, is the fact that it's a player, a colleague of someone, like, in the sense that it's not a fan roaring from the stands, which can be the case a lot of times. But this is actually a player going up against somebody else, an individual that's made this remark. And it's totally, as James McLean says there, in 2023, it's absolutely disgraceful. But sadly, it's not surprising, Damien. And until we get to the stage where more is taken in terms of people taking this stand at a higher level, the likes of this, an under-21 level, even higher again if it goes to a men's senior team, if it goes to a Real Madrid and a Vinicius Junior, until it gets to that point, we will still hear incidents of
because
this.
Because in the grand scheme of things, what benefit? Brazil play in a one-off jersey in a friendly the other evening. First time they've ever played in a black jersey. It was said to be a show of solidarity with Vinicius Jr. Like, I thought La Liga to come out and say, well, actually, he stoked the flames a little bit. Maybe he shouldn't have stoked the flames. For Real Madrid to have come out and said, well, we wanted him to make the decision as to what we were going to do. Like, that's all reprehensible. Where is the leadership? And where is the leadership from football? Where is the leadership from key figures within, like, the biggest clubs in world football who have the ability to instigate change and instigate positive attention on all of this?
Yeah, it's we'd be here all night debating that, Damien, because you could throw into the mix, where's the leadership from UEFA on incidents like we saw Friday night with the Irish fans not getting into the ground, and the Champions League final being staged in Istanbul last week when it was an absolute shambles.
2 years in a row where it's been a shambles.
You know, so like, there's a load of different things like that, and you're on about leadership, and it needs to come from governing bodies such as FIFA and UEFA. If they can't even get stuff like that right, how are they going to deal with situations where, as you said, this isn't just a sport issue, this is a society issue as well. So...
But you understand my point that if you have Real Madrid playing a La Liga game and Vinicius Jr. is getting
the abuse he's getting,
can you imagine the strength of the image of 11 men walking off the pitch and saying, we don't care what's happening here. We don't care that there's a football
match. We debated this, Damien, the night after we were here, and the first thing I said is they should have all walked off the pitch.
And the issue that comes back is... you would be breaching broadcast contracts, you'd be breaching sponsorship contracts, you'd be breaching participation agreements. So you would be punished and condemned for taking a societal stance.
Yeah, but I also think that's when people will stand up and take heed, because as you says, if there's broadcasters and the money, and we all know the TV rights in terms of the football money nowadays, if there's broadcasters and there's no players on the pitch and people are walking off the pitch, all of a sudden you'll have getting them involved, and they'll be the ones going to the likes of the governing body saying, this, you need to take a stand against this and take, as you say, proper punishments against these clubs or individuals or people who are carrying out this behaviour. Because it's only at that stage, Damien. Sadly, we're having these debates and discussions that we're saying that we're calling out for this to happen.
Yeah.
But that's how far it's got. That's where we're at in 2023. And until that happens, you mentioned earlier again, I go back to the start of the conversation about why is this not the norm? Why isn't it the norm?
I agree. But I'll ask you another... And we're kind of all guilty of this. Like, you know, I have had situations where I've probably been on a dart or I've been in some public arena where I've seen something happen. And have I stood up and said something? No, I haven't. So it works in multiple ways and multiple levels.
And that's when it becomes...
And then equally, should I be... Okay, you could like say, well, like, sure, listen, if you don't take some stance against it, why should you expect Carlo Ancelotti or Vinicius Jr. or Real Madrid or something to do? Like, it is a societal problem, but the problem is time and time again, when it comes up in these areas of elite sport, it'll be kind of... Some action will presumably be taken, potentially... And it'll be kind of all brushed aside.
Yeah, because it's lip service to pay to it.
Football unites, and let's get two teams together to shake hands before a game. And
that's what we've seen for so long now, and that's all rubbish. Has that worked? That's the question I'd ask. Has any of that worked?
Yeah,
no.
Mark Langdon's with us. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Daniel. You okay?
I'm good. Listen, you and I have probably had this conversation on programmes before. We may well have this conversation on programmes again. And listen, I like we're getting hot and heavy and we're getting like wound up about it, but like, it is a societal issue, but it is an issue that sport, and not just soccer, sport in general, has failed to really grasp and nettle and lead on. Is that a fair observation?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I do think that what you mentioned earlier there about maybe teams or players being wary of the consequences, maybe a sporting, you know, punishment in points deduction or a fine or something like that. I mean, I think that, you know, that that shouldn't be the way that it is. I mean, I think it would be a remarkable stance if we go to, say, the Real Madrid incident. Imagine if, you know, they would have been deducted points had they not finished that game. I think that would have, you know, humiliated La Liga or the Spanish authorities or whoever made that decision. If you, you know, if a broadcaster did suddenly want some money back after that, there was an incident of racism and a team walked off. Again, could you imagine the uproar against that media organisation that was sort of, you know, asking for money back? I think it would actually, you know, really put the pressure on UEFA, FIFA and the league governing bodies if more teams took that action. And also just from the QA in this instance, you know, the QAT sort of reasoning and response, you know, that's absolutely disgraceful. Now, maybe you can back your own players and believe that the incident didn't happen, but, you know, there's no way that that's why the game was called off. You know, and it's huge. It should be a huge embarrassment to them that they pretended that the game was called off because, you know, that the game had become too robust. You know, so hopefully, on top of that racism punishment, if it's to be proven, they will also be punished for, you know, what is, you know, just complete untruth, really, in terms of, you know, why that game was called off.
And listen, we're deluding ourselves, Alan, as well, to think that this doesn't happen at matches over here and this doesn't happen. Like, it's, you know, it happens everywhere along the way. So
I heard an incident quite recently about it happening in an underage tournament, Damien. And I was sick to the pit of my stomach because we were at the tournament as well playing. And I heard it happened with 9 and 10 year olds.
Yeah. So listen, they're allegations. the FAI are very, very strong in their positioning that this happened and action wasn't taken and we took the action as a result. So presumably UEFA and FIFA will investigate it and will allow those investigations to take course, and we'll wait and see what the outcomes are. Mark, like, we're going to be a positivity of, you know, beacon of positivity and light and everything else. I kind of mentioned at the outset of the programme that we're going to be chatting to you, and effectively the slot could easily be dominated by the fact that Saudi Arabia is becoming the centre of the footballing world. We've Ruben Neves, his transfer from Wolves to Al Hilal, I understand, has been confirmed within the past couple of minutes. Heung-min Son potentially on his way, Matt Doherty potentially on his way, Steven Gerrard not on his way because he's, you know, looked at options that were available to him and has decided not to pursue them. The Saudi money is going to play such a key role in golf, in football, in various other sports in the years to come.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, you know, the when I spoke previously on this slot, when Benzema left for Saudi Arabia, I think this is all part of a campaign to try to get the World Cup, you know, that they have been pushing for the 2030 World Cup. They've got, you know, Messi as an ambassador, couldn't get him to come as a player. I mean, I think that, you know, that there are a lot of different strands to this. It sounds like there are some Premier League clubs that are really unhappy with the fact that two teams that were, you know, very close to financial fair play sort of issues in Wolves and now it looks like Chelsea could potentially kind of have their issues resolved in a very quick way. And, you know, there's some question marks as to whether the market value is being paid for these players. If you look at somebody like Koulibaly, for instance, I mean, there would be no one else in the world that would be able to take on his wages and the transfer fee for somebody of his age, and yet he might be one that ends up in Saudi Arabia. For Ruben Neves, I'm just really disappointed, really. I mean, it's the second time that Neves, with his agent, Jorge Mendes, that have kind of made just the wrong decision for the player in terms of, you know, their ability and where they should be playing. It happened when he left Porto and joined Wolves, if you remember, in the Championship, and Mendes has got very close links to Wolves. Otherwise, you can't imagine that that Neves would have wanted to have played in the Championship. He was captaining Porto in the Champions League as a teenager, and he ended up, finding his way to Wolves somehow. And now, having been linked with Manchester United and Barcelona, and maybe those teams didn't want to pay nearly 50 million for Neves, he's ended up, at a young age, at what should be the prime of his career, just ending up in a league where he'll be able to just stroll through. His bank balance, you know, will be boosted significantly. But I just feel he's somebody that should be playing Champions League football, if not Champions League, definitely Europa League. So I think it's a concern for the European teams. I mean, some will be using it to their advantage, as I just mentioned, but they are potentially going to put prices sky high again, and there's not many that are going to be able to sustain that level with what the Saudis can offer. And I think that the football authorities have got another problem potentially coming down the line, because they've allowed multi-club ownership to develop, and teams have used that to their advantage. You look at the Red Bull situation being one, the City Group being another. I mean, what would happen? I'm just throwing it out there. I'm not saying it will happen, but if one of these Saudi teams puts in a ridiculous bid for, I don't know, Ryan Fraser or some other kind of bit part player at Newcastle, you know, we know that there are links between Saudi Arabia and Newcastle. Would anybody be able to stop that injection? Because at the moment, Newcastle can only spend a certain amount of money because of financial fair play. Are there any rules in place? I don't think that there are, to stop them potentially doing something like that if they so wish. I'm not saying that they will, but it's another layer to, I think, what is a very complex problem for football authorities. Yeah. Once again, once they've dealt with racism, that they can have a go at this as well.
But Alan, I want to get your view on Matt Doherty in particular in a minute. But Mark, just even on that, to develop that somewhat further, like, it's this thing about, and there's a couple of cases of it brewing in the Premier League ahead of the next season. Sleeve sponsors, jersey sponsors, and when you start to look into the parent companies and you go through the parent company of the parent company of the parent company, it all travels back in the one direction. So again, you look at, like, Kieran Maguire, the professor in football finance on Twitter, is phenomenal about breaking all of this down. But this again is where, you expect or you talk about the onus that's on the Premier League, La Liga, the other governing bodies to actually say, no, sorry, we need to properly get in under the bonnet of this and see where this money is coming from, because otherwise it is just going to distort the entire thing. And before we know it, we're going to be sitting down at the weekend to watch the Saudi Premier League on subscription-based television channels. Well, maybe not. They might give it to us for free, because that is where every notable player in the world is going to be plying their trade.
Well, I mean, it's potentially that way. I mean, you know, China had a go, didn't they, for a little while, and tempted some good players. I remember Oscar being one from Chelsea, and they ended up with some ageing players, but never felt sustainable. The money that is on offer, you know, from the Saudis does feel, at least until the World Cup. Now, whether, you know, if they maybe don't get the World Cup, and, you know, I mean, there's always the possibility that they just lose interest in football or golf or whatever sport it is that they're sort of trying to get themselves heavily involved into, that at some stage they just pull the plug completely and move on to something else. But, you know, I think a regulator would be needed in English football. But, you know, the government, in terms of our government, I mean, you couldn't trust them to do sort of anything at the moment. So I think that regulating football is way down their list of priorities as well in terms of the Premier League.
Yeah, we'll leave the politics to one side. Alan, Matt Doherty, 31 years of age, like you look at it and say, you know, he would have made good money at Spurs, relatively speaking. He may not have been on astronomical money at Wolves in advance of the move to Spurs. He's 31. I can't see him getting a Premier League club if he wants to come back to England.
I think if he gets a Premier League club, it'll be someone down kind of the lower echelons of the Premier League.
So can we castigate a fella for wanting to cash in and spend the twilight of his years out in the sun of Saudi Arabia?
I don't think so, especially when you look at the figures that are being bandied about for all the players that are in the mix. And obviously Mark spoke about Ruben Neves. He's in the prime of his career and he's obviously thinking of that move as well. So for Doherty at 31, after having 6 months of no football at all at Atletico Madrid, obviously, he's probably thinking this is the last big kind of payday. Do you go back to the Premier League for a year or two and struggle at one of the lower end clubs? Or do you go over there for that big payday and sail off into the sunset? And I think that's probably on the cards, Damien. As you says, can you blame him for that? Probably not with the money that's been offered. But the worry I have is for football in general, because if this becomes all the norm, with the money that is, as Mark said, that it almost feels like this is far more sustainable and this is what they want to do. Where, like, look at the players that are being, like Son, like who would have thought he'd go, you know, like if he was to go out there and all of a sudden they're able to attract, not lads, the likes of, I always feel with Benzema, he's obviously at the tail end of his career, his best days you feel are behind him. But if they're able to attract players who were in the prime of their career, then we're in trouble.
Yeah. Before we let you go, Mark, a couple of bits of transfer news. Like, we, you know, stuff is starting to bubble up. The big one, obviously, is Arsenal and Declan Rice. And, you know, like, let's be honest, this is kind of just dancing the dance. Arsenal know what West Ham want. West Ham know they're going to get it. But it's just a case of let's get this over and back out of the way before we inevitably settle on the deal that we know is going to happen, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you've nailed that one there. Obviously, Arsenal are trying to, because it looks like, you know, they've kind of cornered the market really with Declan Rice. They feel they're in a good position because the player wants to go there, and are now sort of testing West Ham's patience. But, you know, I think that West Ham eventually will hold out and get what they want. And it seems to be more about the kind of structure of the payment and then also the bonuses, you know, all that sort of 10 million if you win the Champions League and go invincible for a season and he wins the Ballon d'Or and all of that. I think West Ham just want more achievable bonuses, and I'm sure that, you know, eventually they'll come to a conclusion, and he'll be a really good signing for Arsenal. Some a player that you feel like they need and takes them up, if not to Man City's level, then certainly a bit closer than they would be at the moment.
Just to finish, Alan, we're analysing the draws for the various Irish clubs in European competition. Shamrock Rovers, it certainly would feel like a favourable draw for the first round of the Champions League qualifying. They're going to play the winner of the preliminary qualifying round, which is four teams who play one leg semi-finals and a final. Athletic Club de Escaldes from Andorra, Podgorica of Montenegro, Trey Penn from San Marino, the Icelandic side. Breda Blick, I'm not going to pretend I know anything about any of these, but on paper you would think the champions of Ireland would have quite a good opportunity against any of those teams.
Yeah, you would think so, especially the Andorrans and San Marino, probably a trickier one in terms of Montenegro and the travel as well. Possibly the Icelandic could be a bit physical side, but you would think Shamrock Rovers would have enough to get through. And obviously, if they get through that one, what's key for them is the backdoor option, if you like, Damien, because the Conference League group stage is where they're aiming to be, and in a group as well, in a group stage. The other draw, I think, for the Europa League teams, again, favourable draws. And to be fair, the last couple of years, the teams have done quite well in the European running. And when you think of the money that's on offer, it's so vast compared to what we're playing off for every day in terms of the lack of prize money for winning the league, really. When you think of the money you can accumulate for just getting through a round or two, it's so important for these clubs.
Dundalk have Bruno's Magpies, who quite literally are a pub team. There was a brilliant article by Rory Houston, our colleague from RTE Online, last year. Derry City are off to the Faroes.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if Bruno Magpies were the fellas that rocked up to the Aviva last night as well, because they were every bit of pub team.
Well, here, I'll show you the picture. This is great for radio.
I recognise him. He was number 10 last night, that fella.
Anyway, listen, Mark, I'm not going to expect you to know anything about F91 Didelange of Luxembourg.
Well, no, they're reasonably well known for this level, I think. I would say probably in terms of the draws, that might be the most sort of difficult one, really, because Luxembourg's coefficient is 42, and League of Ireland is 36. Now, you always get there are fluctuations within that, but certainly from a kind of league coefficient, that's closer than the other teams have got. And I always think at this stage, the first thing I look at is the coefficient. And Dudelange have actually made a bit of progress in Europe over the recent years. Oh. So maybe that's that looks a more tricky than Bruno's Magpies, I would say.
Yeah, and HB Torshav.
Did you see play Dudelange?
See, this is where we get confused, because we know them as one thing and then they change the names all the time. You know?
Like, well, what's
Serena Vezda, Red Star Belgrade. You know, it's the spell, you know.
I would have thought
we're simple men.
D-U-D-E. It's not the Dudelange, whatever that is.
Mark. Thanks for your time as always.
No worries.
Great
thank
to catch
you.
Up with your Mark you, Langan Mark. Of the Racing Post with us there. We've got a break to take. We're miles over time as always. Stay with us. Ruby on the way.
Game on 2FM.
You're very welcome back to the programme. Let's go straight to Royal Ascot. Ruby Walsh, how are you?
I'm good, Damien. Yourself?
Not too bad. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us. We can hear the hustle and bustle in the background. Come here, can I ask you, just from a racing perspective, I often wonder if Royal Ascot doesn't quite get the attention for the standing that it has. Like, with all of the festivals and meetings that you would populate over the course of the year, where does this stand compared to the rest?
As an international meeting, Damien, it's huge. But I suppose with Irish people, with our love of National Hunt racing and everything that goes with that, possibly we don't pay enough attention to Royal Ascot. But globally, this is a huge event. Now, it's obviously just outside London, but it is a huge event. I mean, the crowd did feel a little bit small today, which was probably somewhere between 55 and 60,000. But you've all a lot of the best horses in the world. You've international competition, Australia, there's no Japanese runners, but lots of Irish runners, French runners. It is a huge meeting for flat racing, but I think in Ireland we love National Hunt racing, and maybe at times we don't pay enough attention to the flat, which is so important.
And a brilliant day from an Irish perspective when you look down through the winners, like Paddington for Aidan O'Brien in the St. James's Palace Stakes, River Tiber in the Coventry Stakes, Victory, was it Willie as well? In the Copper Horse Handicap. Like, you know, again, horses from this country have gone and have dominated.
Yeah, and really dominated, and Paddington in particular. I mean, you're talking about the most elite level there in the St. James's Palace. You had Chaldean, the English 2000 Guineas winner, versus Paddington, the Irish 2000 Guineas winner, and Paddington absolutely put him in his place. Ryan Moore sat just behind Frankie Dettori on Chaldean, and it was actually a bit strange here in Ascot, actually, when Paddington went by Chaldean. I think the only people shouting were the Irish. The whole atmosphere in Ascot, Frankie had ridden in Spiral in the first race. He'd ridden Chaldean in the James's Palace. And look, obviously, this is Frankie Dettori's last week riding in Royal Ascot. And Holly Doyle is just walking by. So I have to say, well done, Holly Doyle, who won the King's Stand.
Yeah, with Bradstell, 14-1 winner.
With Bradstell, yeah, she's just leaving the racecourse here. But Paddington was exceptional, and the turn of foot he showed, and he's another superstar. But to be a little bit technical, Damien, Paddington is by a horse called Sayuni. So for Coolmore, which is the stud behind Ballydoyle Racing, Paddington is an outcross to go to stud with. So he's not by Galileo, he's not by one of the Coolmore stallions. So with all the mares they have, a horse like Paddington helps them to build the breeding empire that they have. So Paddington was a really important winner for the industry that goes on behind the sport.
What catches your eye then in terms of what people can look forward to tomorrow?
Tomorrow, obviously, you've got the Prince of Wales. And again, it's Aidan O'Brien. It's Ryan Moore in Luxembourg. You have Bay Bridge, who would be a huge runner. And you have Adair, last year's Derby winner as well, for Charlie Appleby and William Buick. That's the feature race in tomorrow's card. And you obviously have the Queen Mary, which is the two-year-old contest. And again, look, Ascot is for everyone. There's the elite races, the group ones, and then there's some really competitive handicaps. And you've got the Hunt Cup tomorrow, which is a 30-runner handicap. 30 runners coming a mile straight up the Ascot Straight. The horses will come the very same track that the Royal Procession comes. They'll come a bit quicker than King Charles came in his chariot today, but it'll be an interesting race to watch.
I presume you've met all the Royals, have you?
I've met a few of them, up and down, here and there. But look, they have titles with their normal people.
Yeah. I saw Willie in a chariot today as well. That was the first time I've ever seen that.
No, it's the second time he was in it.
Was it?
we were slagging him today. What is he going to be deserve to be in it twice? But that is part of the pageantry that is Royal Ascot, yeah. And the Royal Procession is a huge part of it. And for horse racing, it was very important that King Charles was here today, with the Queen, Camilla. And you know, that's, look, it's probably not something that every Irish person buys into, but that is a huge tradition in the UK, yeah. and it makes Royal Ascot what it is.
And we were wondering if that perhaps feeds into the fact that it might not necessarily get as much attention over here as it might deserve in sporting context. Ruby, enjoy your evening. Thanks so much for being with us. Look after
Cheers,
yourself.
Daniel.
Stay safe. Ruby Walsh.
See you, Alan.
See you, Ruby.
From Royal Ascot. So plenty of updates on that.
It's phenomenal.
You'd have a shot in a carriage if you got a chance.
Willie deserves one. Willie's a legend.
Nice
Willie and Aidan O'Brien. Do they get the credit they deserve?
Here they do, but maybe abroad they don't. Break to take. Back after this.
Game on 2FM.
And it's about 15 minutes or so until we hand over to Betta. Some sad news reached us earlier. Belfast native Jim McCourt, who won an Olympic boxing medal for Ireland in Tokyo back in 1964, has passed away at the age of 79. That medal was Ireland's only medal at those 64 games. He won multiple Commonwealth Games medals. He was a European bronze medalist and a seven-time Irish senior champion. And if you speak to people who are massively invested in boxing, they will tell you that his legacy and his legend was one which cast an enduring shadow over sport. And he was somebody that many generations of Irish boxers wanted to emulate in terms of what he had achieved. So our thoughts this evening are with his family and his friends and everyone who held him closer yesterday. Grev Adam Dealish. That's Belfast's Jim McCourt, who has passed away at the age of 79. We're going to finish the programme with a story which developed over the weekend. We didn't have an opportunity to rightly get stuck into it last night. And that is Brendan Rodgers returning to Celtic, having obviously been out of work since his departure from Leicester City. And who better to chat to than Roddy Forsyth? He is at Hampden Park in advance of a big night for the Scottish national side tonight, and I've been chatting to him earlier.
Game on.
Football.
Big story, Brendan Rodgers. It's akin to that lover that jilted you. You deleted them off Instagram, you blocked them off all your social medias, and then all of a sudden they're back in your life. This is it unexpected, or was it the sensible approach for both sides once Postecoglou moved on?
When his name first appeared in the reckoning, people were certainly taken aback. I must say, there was a feeling about that, as you say, Celtic had gone back to someone who jilted them. The Green Brigade, who of course expressed the more extreme views of the Celtic support, had come away with some banners saying that he had chosen mediocrity over immortality. And one of the problems with Brendan is that he had a habit of talking about how green the blood flowed in his veins and that he was virtually born to be at Celtic Park. That's until Leicester came along. And so it was felt that at the time an element of betrayal was certainly playing its part here. And don't forget, While his wife and daughter were at home, someone broke into their house and stole his medals, his Celtic medals. So there was, he obviously had angered the wrong type of people. And yet, when the in the initial days after his name resurfaced, there was some abuse online. But there's been a change in tone. I wouldn't say that he's got a unanimous verdict, pretty far from it, but he certainly has managed to swing a significant number of Celtic supporters who are saying online on social media outlets, look, he did a couple of trebles before, back-to-back trebles. One of them was an unbeaten domestic run in all competitions. Surely that counts for something. He's following a man who's just delivered a treble and who also went off pretty sharply, although without the disdain that was levelled at Brendan. So let's give him a chance. He's up against a stronger Rangers team now than he was back in the day. And of course, you can only play what's in front of you. Celtic supporters will say that adamantly. But there's no doubt that Rangers are a little more of a prospect than they were this time when he was there.
Does it say more, though, about his mindset, where he wants to be seen, the platform that he wants to be able to perform on, maybe publicly or professionally, compared to the other options that people talked about in terms of, you know, to go to the Championship with Leeds? Because Celtic internationally is now seen as a club where managers can go, can make a name for themselves and can move on somewhere else, as Postecoglou did. But is it a marriage that is of perhaps more benefit or convenience to Rodgers than it is necessarily to the club?
That's one thing that the Celtic supporters are alert to and will be watching out for. Celtic are in the Champions League group stage next season. That's important because the new manager knows that he has a stage to perform on, but he didn't perform particularly well last time he was there. Now, there were two very good draws, home and away, with Manchester City. I was at both of them and they were pretty thrilling, I have to say, and they were high quality. But Brendan's habit of getting, and it's a simple formula when you think about it, you get as many of the best players in Scotland as you can, you make sure that they're fast and fit, and the chances are nobody will be able to cope with them, with the possible exception of your direct rivals, Rangers. The problem with that and the possession game that he played was it didn't work very well in Europe, and they conceded 7 goals to Barcelona in the Nou Camp, they conceded 12 goals to PSG home and away, and those were pretty well verging on humiliations as far as the Celtic support was concerned. So from that point of view, you can understand why Brendan has been asking for a budget significantly higher than he had before to buy players. Celtic didn't have to buy big name players in his first spell there because Rangers were not a big threat to them. Rangers are rearming at the moment. We've no idea how effectively, but they've begun their summer spending, and so Celtic must respond. And of course, they've also given Brendan the highest wage of any Celtic manager ever. We believe that's around £3 million or so.
Which is considerably...
£3 million, I should say.
Yeah, which is, by all accounts, considerably above what he was there previous time round.
Yes, and he made some noises previously about the board's parsimony, and the board didn't take kindly to that. The Celtic board never take kindly to references to their parsimony, because the boards that they replaced when the Great Revolution happened under Fergus McCann in the 1990s were known as were reputed to keep their money in a biscuit tin. So there's a raw nerve that you can touch there, and Brendan did touch it. Of course, some of his detractors felt he was moaning about the board to cover up the deficiencies in his own European strategies, and that may well come about again. The big test will be the group stage of the Champions League.
And let's be very honest, you and I have had conversations like this on this programme and others for many, many years, and we are all big enough and old enough to realise that it is a fickle world, and if he comes out and he shoots the lights out for the first couple of weeks of his tenure, the, you know, flirtation with Leicester will be very, very quickly forgotten, and all that Postecoglou had done will be quickly forgotten about as well. So he knows the, you know, the nerve centre that he is walking into.
Only one Brendan Rodgers. There's only one Brendan Rodgers. That's what he'll want to hear. And as you say, in this fickle world, a good start to the campaign would serve him well. He's got an Old Firm game at the beginning of September. That's at Ibrox. If he can prevail there, that would be a perfect start for him, because that's, of course, the most immediate barometer that fans in Glasgow of both sides immediately look to check when there's a new manager. They check it all the time, no matter who's the manager. But that's the first indicator that you may or may not be going to have a successful time. And of course, Rangers know that as well. They've been buying and with the intent of thwarting Celtic's next move. So we're in for a fun start in August and September.
Yeah, and certainly he will talk the talk when the press conferences come along. People will hear in the background the noise and the effects of Hampden Park as you prepare for a big game tonight. tonight. And like looking at the landscape of the Group A qualification table for Euro 2024, Scotland played 3, won 3, 7 goals for, 1 goal against, 9 points, top of the table, clear of Georgia, Spain, who each have a game in hand. It has been the most remarkable of starts for the national side. Mm-hmm.
And history could be made here this evening because no Scotland team has ever won its first four qualifiers. So Steve Clarke has put his players in a position to have something to boast about for the rest of their lives. Georgia have been awkward with Scotland in the past. They've played each other four times. There's been two wins apiece, and in each case, the wins were at home. So Scotland would believe that they can, and will believe that they can win here at Hampden in front of a full house. A little more awkward in Tbilisi, beautiful city, lovely place to go, but very awkward for visiting teams, as Scotland can testify. But Steve Clarke, if he can, as you say, finish this with a victory this evening, the table will look very inviting, and already Scotland are favourites to go through in one of the two qualifying places.
Because we look at it, Georgia tonight, away to Cyprus on the 8th of September. Like, you know, the message presumably is try and put a much distance between you, Spain and Norway, or at least one of Spain and Norway, before you have to travel to Spain in October. And, I can imagine...
Home.
Travel to Spain in October. It's away in October,
travel to Spain and then Norway at home.
I can imagine, like, can you imagine what the final game of the campaign at home to Norway, if Scotland have qualification secured? It would be... Listen, I'll be very honest with you. I was in the Aviva Stadium last night where we... breathed a collective sigh of relief when we scored the opening goal against Gibraltar early in the second half. So maybe I'm being maybe I'm overly envious of my Celtic cousins.
Well, you've not had reason to be for many years, so what goes around comes around, and that's only fair, I should say, in this instance. But although I always keep my eyes open for the Ireland score too. But one of the factors that has increased the standing of this Scottish team over the weekend was the fact that Spain, whom they have already beaten here at Hampden and beaten properly, became the Nations League champions. So the European Nations champions, rather. And in that respect, Scotland's standing has increased. Nobody expects them to go to Madrid and win over there, but nevertheless, if they can put themselves in a position to secure top spot in the group by the time they play Norway, my goodness, what a change, what a transformation that would be in Steve Clarke's fortunes. Because when he first came here, Scotland took a fair beating from Belgium and Russia, Belgium and Brussels and Russia here at Hampden, and there were people who were saying, well, he looked good when he was at Kilmarnock, but maybe we've overestimated this guy's capacities. But let me tell you something about the season before he joined Scotland. He'd been the Kilmarnock manager, and in August of that season, Kilmarnock were beaten 5-0 by Celtic in the Scottish League Cup, and people pretty well felt he'll have a hell of a job to do to keep them away from the relegation dogfight. Instead, they finished third, and by the end of the season, they'd not only beaten Celtic, they'd beaten Rangers twice, and in the calendar year before he went, the Kilmarnock had more league points than any other team, including Celtic. So what we're seeing with Scotland is a transformation that's not dissimilar, in my view. He's making them believe in themselves more. They're getting used to the scale of what they're supposed to be doing, and they're getting used to the patterns, and he has them very... astute substitution skills as the manager. And when Erling Haaland came off the other night, he promptly changed the team, and the team promptly scored and scored again, which is ideally that's textbook material for a manager, and it just makes his players believe in him all the more. I'm just watching him, he's down at the sidelines at the moment talking to a couple of officials, a groundsman and a couple of players. He's a perpetual presence around the side, Steve Clarke, and he is at the moment the unquestioned hero of the Tartan Army in a way that Brendan Rodgers has not quite yet achieved with the Celtic support.
And Roddy, to finish it all off, tie it all up nicely in a bow and make it look like it was all carefully planned, to finish on international football and tie it all back to Celtic at the start, Mikey Johnston absolutely changed the game for Ireland, came on at half-time last night, spoke afterwards about his positivity about Brendan Rodgers coming back to Celtic because he was obviously a manager who had quite a bit of time for him. And like, one would wonder, in an era where there has been so much focus on the allegiance and players from Scotland and Northern Ireland declaring for the Republic of Ireland, he could well, if things go his way at Celtic, become the latest player that Scotland will think, we let that guy slip away.
Well, I think that's been thought of already. But I must say that at the moment, nothing does the morale better for a squad than winning. Then they don't need to talk about who isn't there and who might be there and who should be there and who perhaps is neglected. So from that point of view, Scotland in good shape at the moment. But as you say, this is a fickle game. It would only take a couple of losses and then people would start to say, Johnson, he should have been playing for us, mate.
Yep. Roddy, enjoy the game tonight. Thanks so much for your time,
okay,
as always.
All the best. Take care of yourself, Damien.
That's Roddy Forsyth chatting earlier. It brings the programme to a conclusion. Our broadcast coordinator, Laura Lee Davies, programme produced by Ronan Lawler. Betta Da Silva is on the way. Jenny here later on. Stay tuned for all of those. And from Damien O'Mara, it'll be chat again. Thanks for your time. RTE 2FM.